Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Everybody, this is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. This is show number 115. I'm your host, Tom Riddell, and it is May 16th, 2022. And a little bit about us before we bring in my new co-host. Terry Brown will be with us shortly, and I just cannot wait for that. It will be her maiden voyage here on the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And as I said, more about us. You can find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net. That's thomasriddell.net. You find it in the blog section, and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiddell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we will get back to you. A special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge Showcasing New Authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readzy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge on May 30th, 2022, Wayne Drake will be here with his book, Surrender, a story highlighting the undying resilience of the human spirit and a hope that we can find our true selves, even in the worst of times. On June 13th, 2022, Nancy McLaughlin will be here with her novel, American Nomads. Train hopping and living off the land are featured in this tale, and the characters will grip you, and they fascinated me. It's a top-shelf book for sure. Hope you'll tune in to these exciting upcoming shows. And now, with a little bit of technology, we are going to bring in my new guest co-host to the show, and that would be Terry M. Brown. She's also the author of Sunflowers Beneath the Snow, And if you haven't heard about that, go out there and take a look, because I hear it's flying off the shelves, and Terry will be here to talk a little bit about that. And she'll be talking to us also about a writer's topics. And I'm going to bring her on the line right about now. Terry, are you there?
I sure am. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. And welcome to the broadcast as my co-host.
I'm excited to be here.
And so what's going on in your life these days?
Well, I've been trying to decide which of the 410 topics I wanted to talk about. And so I can't decide if I want to talk about the editing that I can't decide how to do, or if I want to talk about the fact that I got my first one-star rating on Amazon, which,
ooh,
like, yeah. Yeah, I got two of them.
Wow. So could you share with us, not that we really need to, but kind of give us an idea what they told you in those one-star reviews? Were they in-depth?
They said nothing. They just gave stars.
Oh, okay. Well, I think we can dismiss those, because people with any clarity or any real knowledge of the reading of your book would have to say something. Wouldn't you agree, Terry?
Well, I would think so. And so, yeah, it was a little bit, and I got them both on the same day. I woke up in the morning yesterday and they were both there.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was a little bit, it was like, wow, that's harsh. But so I think that, yeah, one of the writer's topics is like learning about how to get a thick skin. Because
yes,
the truth is that there really could be people out there who do not like my book, and that's acceptable. I just don't think I like to see it in black and white.
Right. But yeah, but we could also, we should also point out that you've received many 5-star reviews too.
Oh,
so
yeah, no. I think that's the thing that is that as an author, I had told myself that I was ready for this, that, you know, I knew that there would be people who weren't going to like the book, and that there's also people who like to do things like give 1-star ratings just so that they can mess up somebody's ratings. You know, like, it's a thing to do. And I was ready for it, except that I really wasn't. So,
right.
Yeah, the idea that you have to kind of learn to, you have to take the good with the bad, and you have to believe in your work yourself, and you have to not let someone else's ratings determine, you know, how you feel about the work that you've done. If you feel that you've written a good book, then you just have to move forward and let those, you know, go by the wayside.
Absolutely. And we talked off air about being an author, air quotes around author, and what it's been like for you around friends. And you had a friend in the neighborhood who kind of puts you up on a pedestal, and it's awful getting a 1-star review, and it feels like the air has been let out of your balloon. But when you get those kind of praises from your friends and next door neighbors, it kind of puts you back up in the clouds again, doesn't it, Terry? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It does. Yeah. So I have a neighbor that, you know, I've had over to the house several times, and she's brought her bicycle by for my husband to fix, and, you know, she's just a neighbor. And she stopped by one day, knocked on the door, and wanted to know if she could purchase a book. And when I said yes, she got all giggly like a schoolgirl and then asked me if I would sign it. And so I signed it, and she's like holding it up to her chest going, oh, I've never had a book by an author signed by an author before. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm the same lady I was yesterday before you had the signature on the book. Yeah, so it is kind of funny. And there's both. There's, you know, the people who do that and make you, like, you have to bring me down out of the ceiling, and then you've got the 1-star ratings that do just the opposite. So, yeah, it's a kind of a wild roller coaster ride.
Yeah, I've gotten that too in the few books that I've written, and those positives or those maybe 4 or 5-star reviews that you get kind of sits me back down at the computer, and I'm there for 2 or 3 or 4 days just pounding out another story. But then you get those low class, and I'm gonna say it like it is, but those low class comments and one star reviews that kind of really take it out of you, and you got to sit back for 2 days and let yourself kind of absorb that a little bit. But it's kind of like you have to heal. Yeah, it often reminds me of what must a writer like Stephen King go through. I'm sure he doesn't pay any attention to anything out there that is said about him now, since he's reached that higher level of fame, I guess you could call it. And I know it is with him would be fame. But for authors that are starting out, like you and I and several of the others that have been on the Writer's Lounge over the last 11 years, it's certainly a time, like you say, when you have to grow a thicker skin in this post-writing world that we live in. We write the book, and then we have to deal with marketing, reviews, and all that other stuff that comes along with being an author that we really didn't really think about. I think a lot of us haven't really thought about it until it actually hits us in the face. Right.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I wrote a book. I was ready to release it. And then it was like, oh, wait, that requires all kinds of things I hadn't even considered. And all of the marketing and the highs and the lows that go with the reviews that you get. And even seeing if you can get someone who wants to, review it for their blog. And you get someone who says, oh, yes, absolutely. And then the next person says, no, not interested at all. And all of that does, it takes you up and down and up and down, and you kind of have to figure out how to fly kind of somewhere in the middle of all of that.
Yeah, and I guess, too, leaving just a one star without comment, it kind of makes you want to get into that person's head and say, you know, what is it that made you give it a one star review, and why did you buy it in the first place? Because my guess would be that somebody would read the content of the book. Or, for instance, if you're going to buy a TV, you don't like Samsung, and you go out and you buy Samsung. Why would you buy Samsung when you don't even like the model? That I don't understand.
I read a review one time that made me really laugh, and it was one about someone had gone to stay at a beach house, and they gave it a one-star rating because they didn't like all the sand. And my thought was, if you don't like sand, why are you going to the beach? And it's really not the beach house's fault. And so you shouldn't have given the beach house a one star. You should have given yourself a one star for poor selection.
Right, exactly. Yes. So welcome again. I'm glad to have you.
Thank
it's
you.
Going to be a nice ride. I think we're going to have a lot of fun. I have in the past. And just to give you a heads up on the show lately, we're getting a lot more show requests that are coming in, guest requests that are coming in from authors that are out there. And I'm really getting excited about where this is going to turn up in our listens. The number of our listens, by the way, are approaching 75,000. And I think that's
fantastic.
A pretty good number. It's not a bad number to look at. I know that there's some authors out there that like to ask me, and now you, what is your program going to do for me, and am I going to be able to sell my book? Well, the answer to that question would be, you have to do the marketing and you have to do the legwork to make it happen. We can't just do it by words and being on the show, because to be honest, nobody is tuning in to listen to Tom Rydell and Terry Brown. They're tuning
Not
in
yet.
To listen to the author, and the author is who they're interested in. So if you
exactly.
want your
exactly.
if you want your fans or your audience out there, then you have to plug the show in and share your show with, because again, it's not our show, it's your show. So with that, Terry, I think we get into the next part of our program, the guest author and intro and interviews segment of our program. And today we have on Rob Sanborn, and he wrote Prisoner of Paradise. And I want to remind everybody, if you're listening live to the show, of course you're not dead, But if you're listening live, you can call us at 914-219-0868. Don't be shy. We don't get a lot of calls, but you've got a lot of time to call in, and I'm sure that Rob would love to hear from you. So the book, The Prisoner of Paradise, and here is my partial review of The Prisoner of Paradise. Filled with magic, art, history, action, and a very complicated and intriguing romance, this one has it all. Tintoretto, a 19th century Italian artist, painted the world's largest oil painting named Paradise. Nick and Julia O'Connor have dreamed of going to Venice, and despite a head injury that Nick sustains in a hockey game, the couple makes the trip anyway. Tintoretto's painting becomes central to the couple's time there, since Paradise is found by Nick to be haunted by a voice of a woman in the painting, and that voice seems to be directly calling to him. Julia worries that her husband has become delusional as a result of Nick's head injury, but Nick insists that the voice is from a woman from the 16th century, a soulmate from a previous life. Nick eventually discovers who he was in this past life, and he also learns of an ancient order that is responsible for extracting people's souls and imprisoning them in Tintoretto's masterpiece. Nick becomes infatuated with his past life soulmate as she continues to plead with him to free her soul, but to not do that would mean freeing all of the thousands of souls trapped within the oils of the painting. The ancient order is aware of Nick's plan, and they work and will fight to the death to stop him. While Nick can't just walk away from the love and the pleas of the women in the painting, what will become of his marriage to Julia? Reading fiction can sometimes flare up a desire to learn more about the people and places that inspire a great story. And for me, this one did it exactly that, in epic proportions. Filled with magic, art, religion, history, action, and a very complicated and intriguing romance, this one has it all. The author expertly wove a tale between timelines and kept my interest percolating throughout the entire tale. Rob Sanborn is easily taking first steps and fast steps in becoming a best-selling author. I look forward to future books in this series. And now it is my pleasure to welcome Rob Sanborn to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And Rob, you should be right there. Rob, how are you?
Good, Tom. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And tell Terry and I where you're calling from tonight.
I sure will. So first of all, thank you both for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to speak with you and both meet both of you. And also, by the way, thank you so much for that glowing review and explaining to the listeners about my books. I really appreciate that. I am calling in from Denver.
Oh, okay. Are you way up in the mountains?
Nope. I'm right smack in the middle of the city. I'm actually originally from New York State as well. From you're in Syracuse, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm from New York City. And then I lived in L.A. for about 20 years and moved to Denver with my wife, daughter, and dog about 2.5 years ago.
Oh, great, great. So tell us more about yourself, and how did you become a writer, and who or what inspired you?
Sure. Like I said, I'm originally from New York, lived in L.A. for a pretty long time, and now live in Denver. And, you know, like many writers, I've been writing my whole life. My background and professional training is actually in screenwriting, though, not novel writing. So my major in college was actually international relations with minors in poli-sci and Japanese. But I've always loved movies and also writing. So out of school, I actually worked for the Japanese government for a while. And while I was doing that, I took screenwriting classes and then moved to L.A., where I took more screenwriting classes, got into screenplays, wrote 9 of them, 5 of which were optioned. And this book, actually, I originally wrote as a screenplay. And it was optioned by a production company founded by DreamWorks execs. Unfortunately, the movie was never made, but when the rights reverted back to me, I decided to convert it, or adapt it, I should say, into a book.
Is there a possibility of maybe it getting to the screen?
Well, there's a possibility.
Always a possibility.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Terry, what have you got for Rob?
Well, I know that I really enjoyed getting into that story and learning so much more. Can you tell us a little bit more about the painter and why you chose Tintoretto? Is it Tintoretto? Is that how you
Tintoretto.
Say it?
Tintoretto. Yeah.
Yeah. How did,
yep.
Why did you pick this? Yeah. Why did you pick this painting and kind of like what? You know, like what inspired you to do this story?
That's a great question, Terry. Thanks. So I think to answer why this painting, I need to really answer the whole question of what inspired me to do this story. And, you know, I really consider myself more of a storyteller than a writer. And I'm constantly thinking of story ideas, and they could be sparked by the smallest things. To be honest, it's a bit of a problem for me. I have a list of about 100 ideas I'd love to write, and these could be ideas, plots, characters, themes, and in this particular case, it originally was a theme. So I've always been fascinated with the intangible, indescribable attraction that can exist between two people that goes beyond physical attraction. You know, what is it when you feel it in your gut more than your mind? Or elsewhere in your body, right? Is it soulmates, right? Can two people really be soulmates? And perhaps. And by the way, I should point out that I'm one of the lucky people who found their soulmate, and that's my wife, Tiffany. And today actually is our 15th anniversary of officially becoming a couple.
Wow.
So we first started dating. It's not our wedding anniversary, but yeah. But anyway, so I had always wanted to explore the concept of soulmates in a story, and you know, not just in some sort of intense love affair, which is great, but really, you know, soulmates. So many years ago, I was studying abroad in Hungary and took a short trip to Venice, and there I saw a different Tintoretto painting. And by the way, so Tintoretto was a Renaissance master who was very active in the late 1500s. Mid to late 1500s, and you know, he's not as famous as like a Michelangelo or Da Vinci, but if anybody studies art history, they definitely learn about him. I mean, he's easily in the top 10 of Renaissance painters, especially Italian Renaissance. So anyway, I saw a different Tintoretto painting called The Crucifixion, which is obviously about the crucifixion, and that's located in a museum that's filled with Tintoretto art called the Scuola di San Rocco. And this is in the book, so Tom and Terry, if you read it, you'll remember that this is when Paganelli sneaks in the very beginning. He finds a blueprint and a key, and there's a moment at the end of the scene where he can't resist gazing at the work, and that's the crucifixion. It's not quite as massive as Paradise, which is the world's largest oil painting, but it's still gigantic. It's probably about 25 feet by 15 feet, and it's really phenomenal because, you know, most paintings of the crucifixion are hyper-focused on Jesus on the cross. This particular painting is almost like an establishing shot, like a drone took it, and it's an establishing action shot. You see everything that's going on all over, and there's probably about 75 people in it, and each one looks like a distinct portrait. They're also of all walks of life, different races, genders, ages, social classes, you name it. So it's obviously based on a scene from the Bible, but it's not like all these people are vividly described in the Bible. And like I said, the whole museum is filled with Tintoretto paintings, and there must be hundreds of different individuals. And this is obviously not exclusive to Tintoretto. But I started thinking, you know, who are these people who got immortalized into this particular painting? And they truly are immortalized. They're there to this day. You know, could he possibly have used that many models? Did he have a line going outside his door? And did other artists do that? Probably not, right? So then I came up with the idea that maybe it was their souls that were in the painting, and I combined that with my desire to write a story about soulmates. And that was the seed that then sprouted.
Rob, in regards to Tintoretto, you had mentioned that he was known as the Furious Painter. Can you explain what that was all about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I forgot to mention a small part of the backstory of Tintoretto with my book. which is then I started doing more research on him and found Paradise, which was shockingly perfect in every way. So for the listeners out there, it is indeed the world's largest oil painting. It's about 80 feet wide by maybe 40 feet high, and it also sits 12 feet off the floor in a room called the Great Council Room in a building called the Doge's Palace or Palazzo Ducale, which is located in Venice. And it's about 1,000 years old, and at one point was essentially a combination of like the White House and Congress. So it's this huge room with this enormous painting, and the content of the painting is about the coronation of Mary in heaven. So it takes place in heaven, and there's literally hundreds of people in this painting. When I found that, Terry, you know, that's really how it came about specifically with Tintoretto and this painting, is that I saw this particular painting. I was like, wow, like it's honestly, it still gives me chills to this day about how perfect it was. It is really for the content that I want to do for telling the story. And in terms of being the furious painter, it was because of two reasons. One is that he worked very quickly. And by the way, he also worked in a lot of secrecy. So he was also ended up becoming the perfect person for the content. And then the other thing about why he was called the Furious Painter is because he invoked so much emotion with his work. It was really from his brushstrokes. You know, he just kind of put these brushstrokes on to the canvas and just spoke to the viewer through those brushstrokes and through the paintings.
Huh. Had mentioned that you the research of the Venetian history was amazing, but you actually lived and visited Italy. Can you tell us what that was like for you?
Sure, absolutely. I lived in Florence actually, but I visited Venice three times. Once shortly before that trip, and then one shortly after, which is when I saw the crucifixion painting. And then the third time was actually not that long ago for a research trip for the book. And I've been to Italy one other time as well. And I'm a huge fan of Italy. I think it's one of the best countries on earth. I would go back in a heartbeat. I mean, everything from the artwork to the music, to the food, to just the Mediterranean lifestyle. I mean, it's just imbued with so much culture and not just Renaissance culture, but also ancient Roman and even present day. It's just a phenomenal place.
Right. Terry, have you ever been over there?
Yeah.
I've only been to Italy one time. I got to spend a couple of days in Rome and before I hopped on a cruise and went on a cruise with my mom. And it was beautiful and amazing, and I definitely would love to go back. Had the opportunity to listen to some three male tenor opera singers, and I'm sitting in this, you know, cathedral of some kind in Rome, and they're singing, and I'm thinking, this is just not real. This is like something you see in the movies, and it was really fabulous. I absolutely loved it. How about you, Tom? Have you been?
No, I never been there, but I'd like to at some point. Rob, you mentioned just in regards to the emotions that he created with his art. Do you think that may carry over to what we all do here is writing and being an author? Do you think that we should evoke a lot more emotion? Would that pull in more readers, do you think, or how would you go about doing that?
I would say 100%, and this goes to showing, not telling. I believe it was Saul Stein who really clarified the difference, which is that, you know, when you're telling, you're conveying facts, but when you're showing, you're invoking emotion, and I think that's 100% true. So you I put this actually into my book. One of the characters says this, where, you know, an author could be creating emotion through words, a musician could be creating emotion through notes and music, and an artist can be creating emotion through the visual. And, you know, there's a lot of cases like this, and also even movies or TV. I mean, how many times have we heard a piece of music or read something or seen a painting or watched a movie or TV show or something that has literally brought us to tears? You know, and I think almost everybody has had that experience in some way. So 100%, Tom, I definitely think that can happen.
It just occurred to me, Rob, that being a screenwriter, showing more than telling probably is one of the main ingredients of that craft. Am I correct in saying that?
Absolutely. Yep. It's one of the main tenets of screenwriting. You need to show, not tell, even more so, because you know, with books, you can go into a character's head. But with scripts, everything that's on the page needs to be filmable.
Terry,
so you literally need to be able to see it.
Terry, I think that we do this, I do this quite a bit, but when I'm writing, I have in my mind a picture or a screenshot of how it would play out in a movie. Do you do the same thing with your writing?
Yeah, I do, but sometimes I wonder because my characters, they do a lot in their head. And I would love to sit down and talk about, like, how does one change that into a screenplay, because you're right, you can't be in their head, they can't have all of these head conversations, so you have to be able to find a way to turn that around. But yeah, I've actually looked in the mirror before and, you know, scowled or you know, looked sad and tried to think, okay, how am I going to describe that? Because someone told me, and I really liked the idea, that when you're telling instead of showing, you're not trusting your audience. You're not trusting them to be able to figure it out on their own. So you're just handing them all the information so that they know. But that when you show it, you trust your audience to be able to take what you've written and discover for themselves the emotions, which I really loved that idea.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Rob, in regards to your story, it revolves a lot around reincarnation. Do you believe in reincarnation?
You know, I don't, actually.
Okay.
But that's not to say that I can't believe in the magic of it. You know, it is a bit of fantastical for me, and I think that it's a possibility, you know, and it kind of also, it's like writing about, you know, fairies or orcs and hobbits or any type of magic. I believe that there's a possibility that it can exist, and with reincarnation in particular, I would say that of everything that is potentially fantastical in our world, that is something that I would probably be inclined to believe in, because there's a lot of things that aren't necessarily explainable, like deja vu and things like that, especially when you experience that type of sense in a place that you've never been to, for example. Now maybe it's in our brains, you know, it's like intrinsic from our ancestors and the DNA is passed down. That's certainly a possibility. And in that case, reincarnation is become sort of a scientific thing, right? So I'm going to answer maybe.
Okay.
He's going to be a diplomat.
Yes,
right.
It's probably the best way to be, because there's a lot of readers probably out there, a lot of fans that would believe in that. I'm sort of up in the air on that too. Who knows? It could be either or. I don't know. But your story, what I found fascinating, and Terry and I were talking a little bit about it during our chat, was the idea of how other people are receiving your work. And Terry had discussed getting 1-star reviews. And of course, I know she's gotten a lot of fives, but you had mentioned at the back of your book, I believe, that you read your story to your 5-year-old daughter. I found that fascinating. What was her reaction to your writing like for you?
She loved it, which, you know, to me, to this day is my greatest review so far. And by the way, I should point out to the listeners, anybody who has read the book, it's definitely R-rated. And when I didn't actually read it word for word to my daughter, I recounted a highly abridged G-rated version.
Okay.
yeah. Even the ending, actually, was different. Hopefully she can hear me through the walls right now. But
well, she can read it later
so
on.
I gave her... Yeah, when she turns maybe like 15 or 16 or something.
Right.
So, yeah, she loved it, which just thrilled me. And that was probably about a year ago, and she still remembers it. So she's like one of my biggest fans and tells people about it, which I absolutely love.
Do you think that at some point she might give you some story ideas as she tuned into your career as being a writer?
She already comes up with her own stories. It's incredible. I've actually written stories with her. We're working, and I kind of want to get serious about it because some of these are really good. So I think writing children's books is a lot of fun, and so I want to explore that a little bit more. But you know, it's funny. It's like you never see a book, a children's book, where it's like by an adult with a kid, as far as I know. I don't know why. I mean, it seems like that should be a normal thing.
Yeah. Terry, anything else for Rob?
No, I like the idea that you're also exploring the idea of writing a children's book. Do you, one of the things that I'm worried about is getting stuck in a genre. Right now, I'm writing a lot of historical fiction because it seems like a really good fit for me, but I have ideas for other things. I have a children's story in mind. I have an inspirational in mind. I have a rom-com in mind. Do you ever worry about getting stuck, you know, like pigeonholed into a genre?
I wouldn't say it's a worry or a concern because, my book is a thriller blended with historical fiction and a little bit of magical realism. And as part of the series, and by the way, I should also let the listeners know that this is the first of the series. So I have a 3-book deal with Touchpoint Press, who is the publisher. And the second book, which is called Painter of the Damned, is coming out in October. And then the third book is supposed to be coming out in 2023. And by the way, the audiobook for The Prisoner of Paradise is coming out in August. So the way the series goes, it becomes a little bit even more thriller-esque, so definitely kind of in that Dan Brown Da Vinci Code kind of vein. And so I have a lot of ideas in that genre, so I wouldn't actually mind just writing that. But like you, I have a ton of ideas in a ton of different genres. You know, I have a lot of kids' book ideas and YA books and sci-fi, fantasy. So I would love to write in different genres, and authors can do it successfully. So my goal is to try it out at least anyway and see how it goes. But like I said, that said, I wouldn't be upset by being, you know, quote unquote pigeonholed into like a historical thriller or thriller genre. Yeah.
Besides being an author, I found out that you're also a musician and a furniture maker. What drives those passions for you?
So it's really just the arts and, you know, an insatiable curiosity and desire to do as much as I possibly can. So I play guitar. I've dabbled with some other instruments, used to be in a couple of different bands, and I've also dabbled as an artist back in the day. I had a couple of shows, and as a furniture maker, that's something that's fairly new, but I've made a couple of tables and things like that, and I really do like it. So I just like the creative aspects of it. And that's why I wish I had more time, actually. Terry was talking about this earlier, just the time that goes into, selling and marketing your books on top of writing is really insane.
Isn't it crazy?
So go on.
No, I was going to say it's just, to me, I didn't recognize how much time was going to go into the marketing aspect of it, to the point that you have to actually start setting aside the time to write. Like you have to remind yourself, I'm a writer and I need to be writing because if I don't write, there won't be anything to market.
Yeah, and pretty much every author needs to do this, unless you're James Patterson or Stephen King or whoever. But you know, even with your if you're with the Big Five, especially if you're a debut author, you still need to do all this stuff, whether it's things you're doing yourself or going on book tours and everything. It's just, you know, writing, and I think this is particularly true for debut authors especially, you know, but writing is not really the journey. The real journey begins once the book is out there. It's like building a ship. You know, it's going to take a long time to build it, make it seaworthy, fill it with passengers, but the journey doesn't actually begin until you set sail. And then you'll hit waves, storms, smooth sailing, you name it. You can tell, but I live in a mountain state with my my sailing metaphors. But I'm from New York, so. But yeah, but I think that it is pretty accurate, really. And that's when the journey really, really starts.
Rob, we touched on
I have not considered that before. I like that.
Yeah, that's great. Rob, we touched a little bit on it, but in writing a story, what's more important to you? Is it plot, characters, or place?
That's a great question. You're probably going to think this is a canned answer, but I learned very early on in screenwriting that one of the recipes for success is to have interesting people doing interesting things in interesting places.
There we go.
So maybe it's a cliche, yeah, but it really is all three. I do tend to write plot-driven stories, or at least I should say plot-driven outlines. You know, I consider myself more of a storyteller. It's almost like I'm a maze builder. I build this maze for my characters. So I know the beginning and the end and all the obstacles, and then I find the best people for that maze, the protagonists, antagonists, the dynamic characters, and I drop them at the entry and let them figure their way out or battle it out. But if I had to pick one, I do think it's probably story for, and I'll get into that because I think a lot of listeners are probably going to be like, what? It's characters. So characters make the story, but you can have the world's most interesting character, and if the story isn't good, then it really just falls flat. And that's one of the reasons why some installments of a series work better than others, especially if the characters are amazing. Now, that said, the reader needs to connect with a character enough to go on the journey with them. So, and the other thing is that the story really doesn't get going until Act 2 or maybe the inciting incident in Act 1 at the earliest. Therefore, there's a good deal of time you're spending with the character before the story kicks in. So, final answer, I'd say character first, but then story takes over. But it really is all three.
And Terry had mentioned, and I sort of agree with her, that stories are, or in our stories, especially when you're writing historical fiction, because the place is already there and the plot is sometimes always there, but it's character-driven that moves the story forward, and it's a little bit easier, I think, with historical fiction to write than what you're doing. Would you agree with that, Terry?
Well, I think that for me anyway, having the place kind of, you know, the setting is already there and I know what it is that I'm putting my character into. I don't feel like the plot is there necessarily as much, but at least the setting portion is for me. Although the setting was a lot there for Rob's book. I mean, in terms of, you know, the Venice and how it's set up and where the paintings were and things. So, yeah, I found it really interesting, essentially a historical fiction thriller. It was really interesting. I enjoyed that idea of it.
Anything to add, Rob?
Thank you.
Now, I'm curious, got started, yep. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please, Terry, you go.
No, I was going to say, when you got started writing, did you already have the ending? Did you know where you were going?
I did, but that ending actually changed. So
okay.
I am a very big outliner, and I'm a very big believer in knowing your ending. So I know how the entire series is going to end. And, you know, I know, I don't know about the two of you. Are both of you outliners or are you pantsers?
I'm a pantser.
Yeah, I'm the same.
I'm a pantser.
Yeah, I think the majority of our authors that have been on the show are without outline. I know that James Patterson uses outline, and I studied under him a little bit, and I can appreciate that, but it just doesn't work for me. But I can appreciate, you know, the writer that sits down to uses an outline. And I think probably in screenwriting, you really have to do that.
Yeah, and the way I look at it is that you can, you know, go with the flow, or for the listeners out there who aren't familiar with the term pantser, it's writing by the seat of your pants rather than outlining. And I like to do that while I'm outlining, and this way I know the ending. You know, I don't even think it's necessarily a bad thing to tell your reader the ending. You know, if you look at something like Titanic, right? You know that ship is going down at the end, but
yes.
It's riveting, right? Or any biopic, or really any true story that you're not, you know, if you're familiar with the true story, you know how it ends. But it's still, I think, very interesting. And I think you can, you know, the journey, again, we've talked a lot about journeys, but like how people get to that end. And really, this is where character comes in. So, Tom, to your question, anything to add? I mean, I do think that, you know, character really is probably the most important thing, because like if you do, you know, Titanic is actually a really interesting example. James Cameron could have chosen any passenger on the ship. He ended up choosing someone who wasn't supposed to be a passenger as the main character to follow that story, you know. So I think it really is a very interesting concept of who the best character to tell a story is, actually, as well.
The reviews that Terry and I talked about before you came on, how do you react to them and manage them going forward as a writer?
I was listening to that, and I totally agree with both of you on this point. You know, I've been fortunate that I've had some really awesome reviews, and generally everybody has liked my book, which I love. But I have had a couple of one stars or two stars. There are very few, but it's the same thing, Terry, where there's no comments. I think one 2-star said, like, she didn't like the end, which, you know, it says to be continued at the end. It's part of a series, but whatever. And I've had, I think, maybe one 1-star where that had no comment. And Tom, I'm with you. It's like, I don't know, it's like, why pick up the book if it doesn't sound good? But maybe they didn't finish it, which is fine. I do not expect every single person to like my book, you know. There's people out there who don't like the greatest books ever written or the greatest movies ever made, and that's fine. You know, it'd be kind of weird if everybody liked it. But I do think that it's a little weird when someone specifically leaves a low rating. There's another weird thing, is two other weird things as well. I've heard from people who say they're very stingy with their stars, as if anybody cares. Person is giving away a 4-star, you know. And then the other thing is that people could think, you know, that the greatest literary works of all time are 5 stars, and, you know, 3 stars is actually very good, which is fine. Today I saw a post from somebody in a group that I'm in who got a glowing review, but 1 star. So it's, you know, either the reviewer made a mistake, or maybe thinks 1 star is like number 1 or something. I don't know. It's pretty strange. But,
oh, you know, I've been called the Simon Cowell of reviewers. I've been doing reviews now for over 11 years. And they say I'm really tough on reviews. And to answer that, I usually just say, I just read the book and tell them honestly what the author, I think, really wants to hear. And as I say, I don't give out 1- and 2-star reviews because I don't think it's fair to the author to get those kind of reviews. I usually just pass on them. And then if they hit a 3, then I'll put that up. But I don't think it's fair to somebody that's putting a lot of effort into their work. Like, for instance, Terry gets a 1-star review. I don't think that's fair, because I don't really think that they took the time to really absorb the story. And why would you read through a book totally read through a book that you really don't like and then give a one-star review. I do because I'm a reviewer. But Joe Public doesn't do that. They pick up a book because they just want to read to be entertained. So I could never understand that. But I think a lot of it has to do with they just don't want to be nice people. They're just miserable, and that's what they're doing. So, Terry, loved your book again. Wonderful book. You're going to go far. Don't pay any attention to those one stars. I get them too, by the way. So I understand, but that's how I think about it as far as being a reviewer. Rob, what's the best thing about being a writer?
Oh, that's a great question. Can I just go back to reviews for 1 second before I answer that?
Sure.
With the low stars, something that I like to do, again, I've been fortunate that there's been very few low star reviews, but in those cases, I actually have gone to some of my favorite books and I looked at their reviews and I found low stars and, one or two star reviews. And I'm like, you know what? These people are masters, these authors. And if they're getting one or two stars, I can handle it too. So the best thing about being a writer, I think, is being able to, to tell a story, to create a world, to create people who bring, they take on lives of their own. And I experienced this with The Prisoner of Paradise. I originally wrote it as a standalone script and then standalone book. But during that adaptation process, the story really grew so organically and the characters really took on lives of their own. And then by the end of it, they didn't want to die or pack it up, those of them who lived. but they insisted that the story continue. And that really, to me, is one of the best feelings, to be creating this world. And then the flip side of that is when people read it and they like it and they love it. And it's those two things combined that, to me, is the greatest experience. So creating that story, telling that story, and having people just listen to it, reading it, and loving it. I just get so excited, and I love it when people tell me that they love my book, and it's just that kind of thing. It's really a great feeling.
Well, Rob, we got a little over 7 minutes left. Terry, get another question for Rob?
Well, I'm going to ask you a question, but it's one I don't like to get, so I don't know why I'm asking it. But who are your favorite authors?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Hey, sorry, I wasn't sure if you're asking me or Tom. I have a lot of favorite authors in a lot of different genres, but for international thrillers and historical thrillers, I do love Dan Brown. I think that he's a fantastic storyteller. I also love James Rollins and Stephen King. I'm a big fan of Neil Gaiman, and David Mitchell is one of my favorite authors. And then I also love a lot of literary works, which I kind of vacillate between reading literary fiction and also either thrillers or historical fiction. And so for literary fiction, my current, or I want to say current, like my favorite living literary author is Alma Towles, or Towles, I always forget how to pronounce his name. He wrote The Lincoln Highway and A Gentleman in Moscow. And then,
I love
The
Gentleman
in
Moscow.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm also a big fan of Hemingway and Dostoevsky.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
And others, but definitely all of them.
Yeah. Any advice about the process after writing the story as an editor's, agents, and marketing?
Yeah. So Terry was touching on this earlier. Where, first off, I think the biggest thing, if you're a debut author or you're still working on your first manuscript, is to think about it as you're building that ship now, and then you're going to be taking on the journey. But that ship needs to be seaworthy. So I would say hone your craft. You know, think of it as a profession just like any other. I think far too many writers think they can just sit down and write a book just because they have a laptop and an idea. But it's the same as any other profession. You know, so just because you can put a Band-Aid on a cut or drive a car, it doesn't mean you're a doctor or a professional race car driver. You know, the sports analogy, I think, is a really good one. So just because you can throw a ball doesn't mean you can throw it 95 miles per hour into a four-foot zone with a dude trying to hit that ball and thousands of people watching. And you really, as a writer, you need to think about aspiring to that professional level because the competition is insane. So I think it's like hone your craft and revise. Immerse yourself in the world, you know, take classes, join workshops and writing groups, make friends with other writers and authors, which I think is incredibly important. Of course, read in your genre, you know, go on to the Amazon top sellers in your genre and know them all. And, you know, and I think also with the marketing, start your social media platforms yesterday. Like the best time to plant the tree is today. I think the same exact thing goes for social media. And then once all that stuff is in place and your manuscript is as incredible as it can be, then if you want to go the gauge and traditional publishing route, then do it. And that's what I did. I do have an agent, and I got my agent who I love my agents, Kimberly Brower and Amy Ashcroft. Craft, at Brower Literary Management, and I sent them a query letter, the old-fashioned way, and then they got the publishing deal at Touchpoint Press. So I did do it the old-fashioned way, and it takes a while, but you know, it definitely pays dividends.
Right, Rob, we're almost at the end of our program, and this is sort of your asker moment. I know that you just mentioned a few people that you couldn't have done without. Are there any parting words that you would like to share, and would you like to thank anyone else out there?
Well, for this short period of time, I'll just thank my wife, Tiffany, and daughter, Sienna. But I'd also like to thank the both of you, Tom and Terry, for having me on your show, and also Stephanie Rebell of Book and Wine Lovers Marketing, who booked it for me. So, and again, about my book, it's The Prisoner of Paradise. The second book, Painter of the Damned, is coming out October 25th. People can go to my website, which is robsanborn.com, R-O-B-S-A-M as in Mary, B as in boy, O-R-N, .com. And all of my social media handles are pretty much Rob Sanborn.
Right. Rob, it's been a pleasure. Terry, I think you would agree.
I would definitely agree. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you both. Thank you. It's also been a pleasure from my end. It's funny. It's like these conversations about writing, I feel like we could, I don't know about the two of you, but I could keep going for like another hour.
I could too.
I love speaking with other authors, and I'm excited to read both of your books, by the way. I do look them up, and I'm going to be getting them tonight and reading them. So I can't wait to read them. They sound phenomenal.
Very good. Rob Sanborn, thank
wonderful.
You for
thank
being
you.
On the Reads Lounge.
Okay. Thank you both. Have a great night.
Yep. Bye-bye. And there goes Ron Sanborn, and again, his book is The Prisoner of Paradise. Just kind of search for it out there wherever you find your books. And also, of course, look for Terry's book, Sunflowers Beneath the Snow. I drew a blank there for a second, Terry, but we're on to our last segment of our show. And how'd you think it went?
Oh, I mean, I thought it went really well. I'm going to have to work a little bit, if not cutting over top of you. I think we'll get the hang of our flow as we go. But I think for a first time co-hosting, this was a pretty good time. What do you think?
You had a good voyage, I think. Good maiden voyage here on the Writer's Lounge. And we really appreciate you being here, and I do too. So the final chapter is done, and I want to remind everybody on Monday, May 30th, 2022, at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Wayne Drake will be here with his book, Surrender. It's a story highlighting the undying resilience of the human spirit and the hope that we can find our true selves even during the worst of times. And with that, I will say next time, on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night.
Good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. Secret of the plot. It's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make